Film history may need to be rewritten after a two-year festival tours the world. It's called Unseen Cinema, and it brings together 22 hours of experimental documentary and independent short films, as well as home movies. They were all made before 1941 and portray a film world that was almost forgotten. Pat Dowell reports.
Most film histories state that the American avant-garde begins in 1943 with Maya Deren's film Meshes of the Afternoon. But there was an American avant-garde before World War II, says Jan Christopher Horak, editor of the book Lovers of Cinema and curator at the Hollywood Entertainment Museum. He says those early experimenters forged a film culture out of almost nothing.
In the post-war period, you have a whole different infrastructure growing up. You have university film courses, you have government grants, you have Guggenheims, etc. None of this existed in the 1920s and 30s. So a lot of the filmmakers were forced to kind of have two tracks to their careers, one being work for hire, the other being the work they really wanted to do. And they really saw it all of as a piece. They didn't divide between work for hire or their own more avant-garde work.
The filmmakers were Hollywood professionals, painters, sculptors, and farm women in Maine. Elizabeth Woodman Wright made movies of summer visitors and everyday life on her farm. Joseph Cornell, later a prominent sculptor, re-edited shots from a B-movie he liked and set it to Brazilian music. A newcomer to film, Orson Welles, appeared in a social satire. And then there was Archie Stewart, a New York car dealer who bought one of the first home movie cameras equipped with sound.
Now what do? We blow it out in one breath?
Yeah.
Let's go out in one breath, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And what happens if you don't blow it out in one breath?
You don't get away.
Archie Stewart's home movies span 70 years and show a remarkable personal style, says Bruce Posner, the curator of the traveling festival Unseen Cinema.
He had a really congenial way of making a movie that personalized it in ways that are not in the normal Hollywood film. I mean, this is something where there's a direct dialogue because he recorded sound on film at the time, which was pretty amazing for the 30s.
And?
Yeah?
You remember about a year ago, you and I had a reading lesson.
Yeah.
And you did me a little reading. Now, let's see if you've improved any in the past year. Start right here.
Once upon a time, not very long ago, really.
Archie Stewart thought he was making home movies, but historian Chris Horak says that many later filmmakers who are certifiably avant-garde were doing the same thing.
A lot of the post-war avant-garde films are, in fact, very much like home movies. Ben Brakhage makes a film about his wife having a baby. A lot of the films that Jonas Mekas made are personal reminiscences or are him meeting friends, etc. They are indeed a lot like home movies, and yet at the same time, they're a little more poetic. So it makes perfect sense to show that kind of amateur film that looks a little bit like a home movie but has higher aspiration and include it within the avant-garde, because indeed in the post-war period the same thing happens.
Horak's book, Lovers of Cinema, was one of the inspirations for Bruce Posner to put together his series. It juxtaposes very different kinds of film, Busby Berkeley dance numbers, abstract animation, medical information films, and expressionist dramas. Posner says he hopes that audiences will recognize the visual similarities and the shared creative spirit.
All along the development of the project, one of the biggest criticisms I kept receiving was, oh, that's not avant-garde. You know, a Hollywood film is not avant-garde, or a documentary is not avant-garde. But they are in so many ways.
And in the pre-war years, the walls between the avant-garde and Hollywood and documentary work were not quite so high and thick as they are now. For instance, Robert Florey made his experimental film Skyscraper Symphony with its rhythmic arrangements of dancing high-rises while he was in New York to direct a B-movie for Paramount. Mary Ellen Bute was a painter who began making abstract animated films in the 1930s. She used toys, jewelry, and crumpled cellophane to create abstract compositions. In one, a painted orange triangle dashes through a series of grids and spirals, seemingly bent on holding it prisoner, set to Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor. Bute achieved something that few makers of avant-garde films did. She got them shown commercially, at Radio City Music Hall, no less, says film historian Chris Horak.
That's why she was, for many of the post-war critics, was not even thought of as avant-garde, because she made the films, produced them herself, and then went to Radio City Music Hall and said, I have these films, why don't you show them? And they did. So she would actually developed her own distribution system to commercial theaters. So in that sense, she was doing what many filmmakers do now, is they make their films and they develop their own system of distribution because they have been shut out by the corporate distribution systems.
Most of the pre-war filmmakers have died, but one who knew them and worked and lived with them was dancer Lillian Jacobs. She was married to the late historian and filmmaker Louis Jacobs, some of whose work is in Unseen Cinema. In Footnote to Fact, a silent film shot in 1934, Lillian Jacobs portrays a desperate woman struggling through the Depression. Filmmakers struggled too, Lillian Jacobs recalls, and they formed a community. They scraped together money to rent huge cameras and lug them to friends' apartments, which they used as sets. But even with this cumbersome technology, they were able to express themselves.
Here were these, you know, explorers in a sense, realizing that what they had under their nose was something that they could use to express whatever they felt they had to say, or push the medium itself, which attracted them very greatly. I mean, people thought we were absolutely off our rocker. But when you meet somebody else who thinks the same way that you do and feels the same way that you do, the satisfaction is there enough to keep you going beyond all the opposition and loss, lack of money and the heavy camera.
Jacobs says she didn't even know that Footnote to Fact still existed until Bruce Posner contacted her. In fact, many film histories don't even mention these works because few people have seen them. Several scholars and historians have said they're busy rearranging their summer vacations to see the series. Curator Bruce Posner spent 4 years tracking down the movies and getting new prints made. He points out that even some in the post-war avant-garde were not aware of their predecessors, and yet the commercial world saw their influence in the later work and picked it up.
You know, the ad executives were right there, and so they'd copy, flash cutting, turn the camera into the sun and get a lens flare, fast cutting, music with images, you know, they were scooping it right up. But that avant-garde from the underground, you know, really didn't know about its brethren from 30, 40, 50 years earlier.
Whether the early films on display in Unseen Cinema will change the way American film history is written must wait on scholars to judge the series. But whatever their verdict, the work is being seen once again, and the people who created it rediscovered. Lillian Jacobs hopes people will understand what drove them.
It was passion, the love of it, just the sheer love and the sheer sense of gratification when you saw in reality what was in your head, or what was in your dreams, I should say. I mean, that's the way the whole history of the world, when you think about it. People that think a certain way open doors and other people walk in or they don't walk in.
Lillian Jacobs can be seen in Footnote to Fact, one of the films in the series Unseen Cinema, now playing at the Whitney Museum of Art in New York. It opens at Anthology Film Archives in September. The series will tour the world through 2002. For NPR News, this is Pat Dowell.